Welcome to the Connected Leadership Podcast by Zentano, for forward-thinking leaders who want to lead with confidence, clarity, and impact. We bring you grounded wisdom, real stories from real leaders, conversations that leave you thinking differently, feeling inspired, and ready to act. Let's dive in. Hi, this is Dave from the Connected Leadership Podcast by Zentano. You're about to listen to a Voices of Leadership episode with our guest, Alan Muscat, on the topic of burnout. Now, Alan has recently published a wonderfully written book called The Burnout Ladder, based on his own personal experience on the road to burnout and his subsequent research into just how prevalent this issue is. The conversation is wide-ranging with lots of real-world insights and learning points, and I feel deserves to be heard in full. So for that reason, we're going to release this conversation over two episodes, one this week and one next. In today's episode, Alan discusses his own career and how he found himself on the burnout ladder, and more importantly, how he managed to get himself off. He also discusses how he turned this into a book and a practical model to help other people. In episode two next week, we'll dive deeper into the rungs of the burnout ladder and discuss how to spot where you are. Alan will also talk about tools to provide practical help and will restore your physical and mental energy through a little equation called E equals MC squared. But more of that next week. I hope you enjoy listening as much to this conversation as I did creating it with Alan. Okay, welcome once again to the Connected Leadership Podcast by Zentano. My name's Dave Morris. And today I've got a very, very special guest with me who I'll introduce in a minute. And today we're tackling a subject that so many people quietly struggle with, and that's burnout. Now, I'm going to give some stats here. Leadership today, we know it's demanding. It's been more demanding probably than it's ever been. But I recently came across some research from a Global Leadership Forecast 2025 report, which shows that 71% of leaders report significantly higher stress since stepping into their roles, and nearly one in six is experiencing burnout. This impact goes far beyond personal well-being. Burned out leaders are 34% less effective and over three times more likely to leave their roles. That creates ripples across culture, across performance, across strategy. In other words, burnout isn't just a personal challenge for leaders, it's becoming one of the most significant risks to organizational performance. So today I'm joined by author, coach, hypnotherapist, mindfulness teacher, and creator of The Burnout Ladder, Alan Muscat. Alan, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you, Dave. Nice to be here. And that's quite a long list of credits there, isn't it?
What a talented man you are.
Well, yeah, I'd like to think so.
So before we get into how talented you are, I'd like to go back to the early life of Alan and just find out, for anybody who's listening to this who doesn't know who Alan Muscat is, there might be one or two. Just tell me a little bit about young Alan, you know, where you grew up, what your influences were, and kind of what shaped you to the man you are today. There's a question for you.
That's a very good question. So, as brief as possible then, I guess. So I grew up in the northwest of England, so in St. Helens, which is rugby league country. For those who don't know it, it's not far from Liverpool, it's not far from Manchester. I had a fairly normal, average upbringing, very happy childhood, very into sport, played rugby, football, cricket, golf. Very into sport. Academically did okay. Decided not to go to university, which is really interesting and something that I've thought a lot about in the years since that's happened, you know, through my work and actually how I've analysed my work as I come towards the end of that career. Mm-hmm. I bumbled around doing a few jobs. I started out working for a bank. I like to call it talent spotted by one of the customers of the bank, who was a self-made millionaire, had his own haulage company, road haulage company, and he came to me one day and said, "Do you fancy coming working for me?" And I was 21 or something like that. And he said, "Well," I said, "what's the job?" And he said, "Well, it's assistant manager of his company." And that was a huge leap, because wow. I was this little squirt, you know, this little bank clerk, working on the counter and as a cashier. And then this guy asked me to come and run his company, because he spent most of his time in Florida or the Isle of Man or wherever it was. He had another house, you see. So I was, when I was 21, I was, for large parts of the year, running this transport company. So all these drivers and office staff. And so that was a huge kind of learning curve for me.
Wow, yeah.
And I probably stayed there a little bit too long. I was there about 5 years and I wanted to go and get my degree. So I went to Liverpool University, actually. And then from there, I eventually got a job with Kraft Foods in Cheltenham. And I actually got to know them through that road haulage company because they used to work for them and carry food products for them.
What was your key learning from that initial experience, which sounds, you know, at 21, like you say, you don't really know a lot about a lot because you're relatively young still. What did you learn from that early, you know, experience where you're put in quite a responsible and challenging situation? Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
What were your key insights looking back now?
I was very young. I was perhaps too young to take on the responsibility. When you're being hauled out of bed at 4 o'clock in the morning because the alarm's going off and then you have to go to a, you know, very dark industrial estate to deal with a false alarm and meet the police, it's not fun. but I think from actually work and learning perspective, I just learned about life quite quickly. It felt like all the problems were very real. You know, we had, you know, whether it was a trailer full of glass that we used to carry for Pilkington's glass, or it was a container full of coffee to take for Kraft Foods. If a driver didn't turn in, you know, it was a big problem, you know, service levels and all that. And I found I learned how to respect people because I realized that these drivers, I mean, I didn't come from a driving background. So I'm dealing with these guys who've been doing it for 20, 30, 40 years, and they know all the tricks and they know what they can and can't do. But I was giving them their jobs to do and all that. And I had to sort of learn how to work with them and get the best out of them, but by showing them some respect, but having that balance of, you know, I need to push you to do this because if we're going to make money, I need you to do that extra collection for us, you know, or whatever it is, and not have the wool pulled over your eyes. But that was my biggest learning, I think. It was just learning how to get on with people. And I think I've got a style which is friendly.
Mm-hmm.
I'm probably by nature a bit of a people pleaser.
Right, okay.
Which is probably what gets me on the burnout ladder and gets a lot of us on the burnout ladder.
Okay.
Because, yeah, you sometimes just push too far for other people and compromise your own values, which is something I talk about a lot in the book.
Yeah, and we'll come to them. It's interesting, though, what you say about, you know, I was put in this position, no formal training. And I still think that happens a lot these days. You have people get into leadership roles, management roles, and really haven't got that much formal training of how to do that. Yeah. And as you well know, managing people isn't the easiest job in the world, is it? And it requires a quite a sophisticated skill set, actually.
It was huge. And there was quite a variation because you had basically an Arctic driver, or it was somebody in the office who was an accountant, you know. So you got a very different kind of demographic of people, different skill level of people, different functional levels. And it was tough, but it was really, when I look back, a really enjoyable experience.
Was it? Enjoyable for what reason?
Well, I just felt like at the end of the day, when you looked at there was like a board behind the transport desk and it was all the drivers' names on pegs. And if they all had work given to them, you know, they all had allocations, you felt like you'd just taken this, all the work that came in from the clients who would phone in and say, well, I've got this to go to Exeter, this to go to London, this to go to Scotland, whatever. And if you distributed all the jobs out for tomorrow, you could walk away and say, I've done my job. And then at the end of the month, because I would do the invoicing at the end of the month, and I'd tell my boss like how much money we'd made. While he was sat in Florida, phoning in every now and again, saying, how's it going, Al? I said, yeah, it's great. I'm knackered, but it's going really well. But it was so satisfying.
You alluded to the fact that, you know, you talk about your core values. At this time, had you worked out what the core values were, or did that come later on?
It came later on. I think I was too young.
Blissfully unaware.
Yes, absolutely. Taking everything a day at a time. Okay. And just going by instinct, you know, as you said, very little training other than you know, the boss man who'd made his way through, and just saying, you know, this is what I do, and, you know, this is how I suggest you follow. Mm. But I would find my own way of doing it. We were different characters. And I think that's important, that you do find your own way to do it. Otherwise, you're not authentic.
Yeah, well, I think that's really important, isn't it? For whatever we do for a living, is to try and be an authentic version of ourselves. I fear too many people these days are influenced by other things and other people and are not being authentic. And I think that can cause all sorts of problems, burnout being one of them.
I agree. I mean, I think you go through life, don't you, and you take a little bit of different people. So you kind of, you become this, almost like this patchwork quilt of different skills or styles that you picked up off people. And I picked something up off him, but there's a lot of stuff I wouldn't want to pick up off him.
No, no.
Because that's not, it's not me.
It's not you, yeah.
Yeah, so I think that's important.
So you landed at Kraft Foods.
Yeah.
Yeah. You were how old by this time?
About 24, 25.
So 3 or 4 years after you'd started, yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
So let's tell me about Kraft Foods, and that was the next big step in your journey.
Well, that was another interesting learning, because I hadn't come through as a traditional graduate through a graduate program. I'd never worked for a big organization before, although I'd worked for a bank, but only ever in a small branch. It's like working for a small company. So this big organization, and things done very differently. Things rather properly done, whereas I was used to, you know, a wing and a prayer and, you know, and being sworn at, you know, down the phone by drivers and swearing back, you know. It was very differently done, and I had to learn to adapt. And I did find, you know, my learning from that is how adaptable I was.
Oh, okay.
Because I thought, I've come from this, you know, kind of rough environment, if you think about it, to a... you know, in Cheltenham as well, which is a very, you know, prim and proper place.
Yeah.
With a lot of educated people, intelligent, talented people. And I think I had to fight a little bit, you know, to make myself known. And by that, that's that point I was making earlier about, well, I hadn't had my degree at that point. And in fact, I never finished my degree. So I always had that as a bit of a, I'm not going to say a chip on my shoulder, but like... a little bit of a worry that I was an imposter and I'd be found out.
Well, it's interesting you say that. I was going to ask you exactly that question. You know, Rich and I, as you may or may not be aware, on the podcast at the moment, are going through a series of episodes on confidence, because we've just literally today launched our online confidence program, because there's a massive issue in leadership with confidence. And things like imposter syndrome are a big part of that.
Yeah.
So I guess from listening to you talk there, at this point, you did have some confidence issues. You weren't really... fully sure who you were. There wasn't enough self-awareness there. There wasn't the ability to self-manage some of that stuff that was going on for you. Mm. Yeah. So therefore, confidence ebbed and flowed, did it? Dipped.
Oh,
and...
very much so. And I would say it's probably taken 20 years, maybe even 30 years after that, to be fully confident now.
Okay.
Which is a bit of a shame when you look back. But I think if I knew then what I know now, which of course we all say, it would be different, because I realised that I was just like everybody else. And whether you had a degree or not, you know, lots of people just have fear and, you know, am I keeping up? Am I staying with the pack? Am I going to make it? Do I know enough? Am I respected? All this kind of stuff. Well, I was just thinking the same thing. I just assumed they were much more confident than I was.
Mm.
So... that's my learning, is actually, but it didn't hold me back, because I actually think it pushed me.
Yeah, well, everyone responds differently to this kind of stuff, don't they?
I mean, yeah.
I mean, I like you. I didn't go to university. I didn't want to actually go to university.
Yeah.
I don't think I had the comparison thing where I thought, well, I'm not as clever as them. I just didn't want to go. And I wanted to go and earn some money. And I've never really regretted that decision at all. I don't look at the people who might be academically more gifted than me. You know, some people are, that's absolutely fine. But I don't think that I've missed out or they're any better than me. But you're right. I think that looking back, the thing I didn't have at that age, and the thing that you're referring to, is that degree of self-awareness to manage some of those narratives and stories. And because I had the same thing. You know, I experienced imposter syndrome at more than one time in my career. And that is a difficult thing to go through at the time, isn't it? Because you don't really understand why you're telling yourself these stories. You're not really sure how to get out of that. There's nothing wrong with being chucked in the deep end, but you need to give somebody a little bit of help when you do that. And I think self-awareness is the gift actually to give people.
Well, you're absolutely right. And I've had some leaders that were probably ill-equipped to give me, to help me with that confidence.
Oh, okay.
Simply because they either were too overbearing.
Yeah.
And they weren't trusting enough.
Right.
Or they would just throw me in at the deep end without any help or real guidance. You know,
yeah.
Like real leadership.
Yeah.
So, but that's it. You know, there's a lot of that about, unfortunately.
There is, even today, yeah.
But when I look back, I think if I could do any of it again, I would just trust myself more, that I didn't need to push so hard. Because I look back to those early Cheltenham days, you know, when I was in the office till 10, 11 at night, when nobody else was.
Yeah, just to prove yourself.
And just to feel like I was staying up with the pace, actually, at first.
Right.
And also, I think what it wasn't, were they cleverer than me? I just felt like they knew how to navigate the system better than me, because they'd grown up in this kind of big organization and that's the way things are done. I'd come from a very small company where you can just get things done like that, you know?
Yeah.
So I had to get used to that. And that's where I felt I was at a disadvantage. I didn't have that big company kind of ethos and expectations of how things get done.
And was this the beginning of you starting to experience what you call burnout, or did that come a bit later on?
It came later.
Okay, so tell us about the next step in that
journey.
I will.
So after Kraft in the UK, and we're fast forwarding now about 15 years.
Right.
I went to Canada.
Okay.
So I got a promotion to go to Canada with the company.
Yeah.
It was a great opportunity. It wasn't one of those expat deals where you go and they'll give you a 2-year deal and then they fetch you home.
No.
It was like, if you go, you've got to stay there.
Oh, okay.
So I was basically emigrating. So there was a whole load of pressure around that. That's a long story. But so that was a lot of pressure. Long way from home.
Yeah.
And I was promoted into a role. Which it was fine at the time. I really enjoyed it. And then, so we had, the company was splitting in two.
Okay.
So, and I was put in charge of the supply chain part of that project. Huge responsibility. Went fantastically well. I am not big-headed enough to say that was all because of me.
No.
But I played my part.
Yeah.
And I was well rewarded for it. And it's really quite interesting, this, when I look back, because I got a personalised letter from the CEO of the company, personally signed, and only about 10 people in the company did,
right,
to say thank you for what you did.
Yeah.
Which was incredible. But then after that, I got put into a role where I was the customer service director of the new company that had been created.
Okay.
And as soon as I got that director in my title, it was a real... Oh my God, I'm a director now. And it really felt like, oh, this is me, you know, this is this little squirt that's come from this bank clerk and, you know, transportation clerk that's come from these back streets of the Northwest.
Yeah.
It's not quite that bad, but, you know, and then all of a sudden I'm this director of this big company, and it just felt a bit much, and the company got off to a difficult start, supply problems, meaning I was flying all over Canada, apologising to customers and being beaten up.
Hmm.
And it just felt a bit much at the time. So I got in this tangle of just having to work harder and harder to keep up.
Right.
But by this time, you know, I'd probably been doing that 15 years earlier, but I was young then.
Yeah.
I could cope with it then.
Right.
And by now, I'm in my early, sort of mid-40s by this time.
Right.
That I just think, this is really starting to get to me.
Yeah.
And I think you get that fear of, well, if this goes wrong, what happens to me? What happens to us? What happens to me and my wife, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it's, and we're so far away from home, it just all felt a bit scary. Whereas when you're younger, then you just, you know, you just think, well, if this goes wrong, I'll go and get another job.
What were those early signs then? So this is you on the road to almost becoming burnt out. What did it feel like day to day? What were the sort of things that you can now look back and think, yeah, I should have seen some of the warning signs here?
A lot of it was paralysis of decision making.
Right.
Sort of cognitively, I wasn't quite as sharp as I could have been. A lot of irritability as well.
Right.
And starting to resent what I was doing.
Right, okay.
Because I'd put in a lot of hours. Some of it, you know, really benefited me, benefited, you know, the company. Some of it, looking back, I just think, why did I do that? But I just felt I was kind of losing myself in it. And I was losing my confidence. And I just felt overwhelmed. And I thought, if I'll just keep trying and keep trying, I'll never get out of this. So I have to change my approach.
So at some point you realise this is not an isolated incident. This is ongoing. It's becoming quite regular.
Yeah, it's a good question because, you know, I think we all have good days and bad days.
Yeah, of course
you know,
we do.
And you're going on a Monday sometimes and it feels like the world's against you. And then by Friday afternoon, you're feeling okay again. Or even Monday afternoon, you're feeling okay again.
Yeah.
But I really felt like it was just consistent and I just wasn't enjoying my life.
Okay.
And I just thought, well, you know, I'm losing it here, so I need to do something about it.
I think when I spoke to you before, you said you're not sure you actually got to full burnout, but you realised that you were on a very, you know, negative track and not going in the right direction.
Yeah. Quite right. So because I think when you get to full burnout, that it's a quite a good description. There's nothing left. You know, there's no, you know, it's like ashes, isn't it?
Yeah, like so, a shell.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And I didn't quite get there because I still had some kind of get up and go to say, what can I do about this?
You know, so what was creatively. That moment then? What pinged you into life to think I'm not gonna carry on like this?
I think I just sat there one night watching the TV.
Yeah.
And I can't remember exactly what it was, but just something triggered me to say, you know, I'm dreading going in tomorrow. I wish tonight would not end because I just want to stay here in this comfortable apartment and not go anywhere. And then I just thought, well, this can't keep going. This is no way to live my life. And I realised at that point that I'd been thinking that way for a long time. And so I needed to do something about it. So I got onto Google.
Yeah.
And what can I do about this way I'm feeling?
Yeah.
And it came up with mindfulness, actually. So...
Oh, okay.
This is how I got into mindfulness because it was basically saying, you know, this can help you manage your stress and it said something like, it can help you make you feel younger or something. And I just thought, well, yeah, because I want to feel younger again. I felt old, prematurely old before my time, you know.
Old as in just like knackered, basically, tired out.
Yeah, tired. You looked in the mirror and you just think, well, I look exhausted. I look terrible.
Yeah.
You know, I'm 45 or whatever it was, but I thought I looked 55.
Yeah.
And I just thought, I'm just fed up. And it was talking about how you can de-stress, you can sort of de-age in a sense, because what happens when we have too much stress is that, you know, the chromosomes in our cells, they start to degrade, and that's what ages us.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and makes us more likely to be ill. And all that cortisol, which stops your immune system working. So I just thought that kind of scared me into action as well when I was reading what this could do to me. So I said, I'm just going to do something. And then I found a course to go on, which was just basically an online course teaching you how to meditate and what mindfulness was, which is not just meditation.
No.
And I did it. And I found a lot of benefits really quite quickly.
Are you the sort of person that's quite open-minded? Because a lot of people would think, well, mindfulness, that's that sort of new age soft and fluffy nonsense. Yeah, I'm not going to go anywhere near that. Now, I don't agree with that. And I've practiced meditation in some form or other, on a fairly regular basis. And I find it really beneficial, And I just do it because it makes me feel nice. It makes me feel good and it calms me down. But I do understand for a lot of people who don't understand it, because there's a lot of confusing information out there
Yeah.
Was it you were, I found it out of desperation, or was it, no, I'm quite open-minded, I just need to understand what's going on and find a way through for me?
I think initially when I saw that, I was a sort of bit of an eye roll, you know, it's like, oh, God, this is that mumbo-jumbo stuff.
Yeah.
Like a lot of people, well, still think, actually, but a lot, fewer people probably think like that now, but because it's more open, you know. But there is still that stigma attached to it. But no, I was open-minded in the sense that I need help.
Yeah.
And I didn't go to the doctor.
Right.
I didn't really tell anybody about it at all. Certainly not at work.
Okay.
Because I thought that if I tell my boss, if I tell anybody around me at work, they're going to mark me down as weak.
Yeah.
They're going to mark me down as can't hack it. There was a bit of a macho culture. I wouldn't say toxic, that's not fair, but a bit of a macho culture. I remember one night leaving the office at something like 6:30 or something. And my boss, and she was kind of joking, but maybe she wasn't, just said, oh, it's banker's hours, is it?
Okay.
And I thought, okay. So I've been here since 7:00 this morning and, you know, and I knew she'd be there, probably be there for another couple of hours, but, you know, that wasn't for me. I didn't want to live my life like that. I didn't go all the way to Canada to spend my entire life in the office. So I think I was open-minded. I needed help.
Yeah.
And I wanted to self-help.
Do you think if you had been forthcoming with the people around you in work, that it would have been career limiting for you? Was it that kind of culture where it would have? Because I think that stops a lot of people. That fear of, if I come clean with this, it could harm my career or it could limit my opportunities.
Yeah, I think it probably could have done.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when things are going against you, I've had situations where I've been really under pressure and had too much on my plate.
Yeah.
And the boss comes to you and quite reasonably says, well, I'll take that off you.
Yeah.
You know, and we'll give that to somebody else to manage. And it feels like a failure. And I think it's human nature, to be fair to the manager, to say, you know, have some sense of, what's the word I'm looking for? Have an awareness, perhaps, that person can't handle too much more.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, that's not to say they should just leave it there, because the first conversation should be, you know, why can't you handle it? Or how can I help you handle it?
Mm.
Is the stuff you're doing that you shouldn't be doing, or is the stuff you're worrying about you shouldn't be worrying about? Because, you know, do you know what I mean by that?
I think it's a natural thing. I think for me also, what I've experienced over the years, and I still think this is relevant today, is if you have leaders who are managing teams like that or maybe aren't as self-aware as they could be, they see the world very clearly from their own perspective, but they don't understand it from other people's perspective. Is it almost, you don't know what you don't know, so you're leading in what you think is the best way possible, but it's not a one-size-fits-all approach managing people, is it? Everybody needs something different. You and I, whilst we might have similarities, have grown up in completely different worlds with different inputs and different influences, so we're not the same. So would you manage Alan the same way as you manage Dave? No, you probably wouldn't, because we're two separate people.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think there's too much of that, actually, I've got a way of managing and leading, I'm just going to do that, and not thinking, actually, is what's right for Alan what's right for Dave or anybody else that might be in my team? I still think that's an issue, if I'm honest with you.
Oh, I absolutely agree. And when I said it's natural to have behaved like that, to say, well, you know, I'm just going to almost let you think you've failed.
Yeah.
It's not a good thing, but it's understandable, because the manager's got to get the work done.
Hmm.
And at the end of the day, they also, you know, I took it also as a sign of, we don't want you to burn out.
Yeah.
You know, that those words weren't used.
Yeah.
It was, you need help.
Right.
And could be the right answer, but it might not be the right answer. But I think there is a gap, and it was the wrong approach, because the approach should have been, how can we in your sandbox, how can we make it so that you can deliver?
Yeah.
And that you can deliver healthily.
Healthily, yeah.
The first step of, well, I'm just going to take something off you, didn't help me in the long run. It might have helped me in the short run, but that didn't help me develop at all, did it? And actually dented my confidence.
So you,
but I think it's a natural thing for a manager to do.
Yeah, quite, yeah.
It's a short-term solution.
And it's probably well-meant as well.
Yes.
Well-intentioned.
Yeah, I didn't take it in a bad way.
So you'd discovered through your own curiosity that meditation, mindfulness was actually really beneficial. What sort of benefits was it giving you when you started to do that?
Well, it just a calmness of mind and a clarity.
Right.
I started to relax more. I started to sleep better. You know, the neuroscience shows that, and what happens in reality and practice is that you feel like you've got the same problems in front of you.
Right.
Just your perception of them is different.
Different.
And you feel like, I can handle this.
Okay.
rather than get tangled up in the anxiety of I'm failing and if I fail at this, then this will happen. Then you go on and catastrophize, you know, and how the mind gets caught up in this tangle of thoughts. What mindfulness and meditation does allows you to step back from that and see it for what it is. You know, it's a bit like if you've got like, you know, we've all got electrical cables and chargers and all these things. And if you get them all in a tangle, the worst thing you can do is just pull harder at each end because you'll just tighten the knots and make it worse. And I think that's the way we think, you know, we're trying to think our way out of problems. The way to do it is just step back, say, okay, you know, look at it as a whole and say, you know, what's the most sensible way of untangling those cables? It's the similar thing, really. And you start to be able to look at it for what it is, a reality of a problem, rather than the perception that you built up.
Yeah, and you can change the narrative in your head then, can't you? So there you were. You started to help yourself by doing this. How much longer did you stay in that environment with craft? Or did you, you know, at what point did you think, actually, I'm going to go and do something completely different? Because obviously what I want to get onto is this whole concept of the burnout ladder that you've created. But let's take the journey there.
Yeah, well, I mean, I ended up in a job that I didn't think was suited to me. I was grateful to get the job, but I knew it was probably the last one that I would have.
Okay.
I'd already made up my mind, because I think the key thing is throughout my career, and I think I learned this way back when I was at that small road haulage company, was that I got most joy out of seeing people achieve and seeing people develop.
Okay.
So I come from a teaching background. My dad was a lecturer at university. My mum was a teacher. My brother's been a teacher. You know, my grandfather was, you know, there's a teaching background. And I feel I have this kind of inner desire, inner need, if you like, to pass on knowledge or skills or whatever it might be. I like to do that. So I like to see other people develop. And what I found was that once I'd started to calm myself, I was in the office environment. I started to look around me and look out rather than look in.
Okay.
Because you know what it's like when you're really under stress, all you can see are your own problems.
Yeah.
I started to have the ability to look out and see others and go and think, oh my God, they're suffering exactly the same way as I did. Right. So I started to, I said, I'm doing this mindfulness thing, you know, and it's great, you know. So I started to run little classes and sessions.
Okay.
Relaxation,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And it felt a bit weird at first. And I think they felt it was a bit weird at first, but it was entirely voluntary. And people started to really enjoy it. I thought, oh, this could be a career for me.
Okay.
I didn't know exactly what it was going to look like.
No.
But I thought, I want to help people with mental health problems, because I'm having them myself and I know what it's like to be in it.
Yeah.
And I also know how joyful it can be to come out of that.
Right.
So I'd like to help other people on that same path.
Right. And that was the beginning of you going off and doing your own thing,
yeah.
Was it?
So when I was leaving the company, I trained to be a mindfulness teacher.
Right.
Trained to be a hypnotherapist, which is, you know, just down the road up the road in Birmingham. I trained there and then I set up my own business and I got made redundant in 2019.
Yeah.
And I made the decision that I wasn't going to try and get another job in that space.
Yeah.
It was my chance. It was my chance for my second career. And I think everybody's got a second career in them, haven't they?
Yeah.
And I thought that's what it is. And I want to be a, whatever we call it, therapist, coach, practitioner, trainer. You know, all those things you mentioned right to the start.
So where
I'm trying to be all of them.
Yeah. So where did the concept of the burnout ladder? Because you've written this book now, which I have to say, Alan, is I got to confess I haven't read the whole thing yet because I haven't had to
get through
it. But what I have read of it, it's wonderfully written. It's very, very grounded and real and honest. It uses some wonderful analogies to make the points. It's not overly technical, you know, so it's very accessible to as a read.
Well, I'm not overly technical.
So I think you're putting across something which is really, really important and affects so many people, but in a very accessible way. So how did this concept of the burnout ladder come about, and what made you want to write a book about it? And tell me about that.
Well, I suppose one of the things I haven't mentioned yet is I'd always wanted to write a book, and I've had a few attempts to write something and it was just never really worked out. I've had attempts at non-fiction, attempts at fiction that haven't really gone anywhere. So anyway, I suppose the book came about a client that I was working with. So I had set up on my own business.
Yeah.
But I also had a joint business with an old colleague.
Yeah.
And we were going in and talking to employees like ourselves who'd had problems that we'd had.
Yeah.
And one client said to me one day, have you got anything specifically on burnout? Because burnout just seems to be very prevalent here. And it's a word that people are using a lot, you know, okay, for this particular customer.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, yeah, of course. And I hadn't really, other than my experience.
Yeah.
So I did some research on it and I went on to LinkedIn and I saw one day that somebody posted this 15-stage process of burnout.
Okay.
This is how burnout happens in stages.
Right.
And I thought, hey, well, 15 is quite a lot to remember. I don't think I can remember 15 things.
No, not me.
But I learned from that and I thought about my own experience and how burnout builds from like a kind of an unknowing state.
Yes.
You're unconsciously incompetent almost. It's happening to you, but you don't know it's happening to you. Because the early stages of burnout are very kind of enticing and seducing.
Okay.
Because somebody's asked you to do something and it might be covering for mat leave or you've got a promotion. You've stepped up. And to do that, you have to increase your personal resources to meet mm-hmm. the challenge.
Yeah.
When you do that, there's all kinds of things that go with that. There's dopamine hits in the sense of I'm achieving here. You kind of get the endorphins of, you know, achievement and reward. People are telling you, oh, great job, you know, I love the way you've stepped up. Great.
So especially for a people pleaser like you, that's
right.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, it's a little
It's like
pat.
A drug, isn't it?
It's a pat on the head.
Yeah.
You know? And I'm like a dog going, you know, give me another treat.
Yeah.
And I think that's why we get stuck in it, because it's very hard to know where the line is at that time. Where are the boundaries at that point? Because, you know, somebody says, well, do you want to do this project or not? And you think, well, if I turn it down, that won't look very good.
Yeah.
And if I turn it down, then so-and-so over there will get it.
Mm-hmm.
And that means they'll be above me in the pecking order in future. You know, all these things, because we're tribal people, aren't we?
We are.
And we compete. Yeah. And we can't get away from that. This is basic human behavior.
Yeah.
The way, you know, it's hardwired in us. And I think we're wired to do this. So, which is why we end up getting stuck, because we then progress along this path. And after a while, you realize, well, to keep up this pace, I need to neglect things. I need to neglect myself. I might need to, you know, not spend as much time with my friends, family, whatever it is. And then after that, you kind of start to become resentful of it.
Mm.
And then after that, you just think, oh, God, I realize what's happening to me now. And then you end up in the latter stages of the ladder, which is where you really are starting to get depressed and you're really starting to think about, you know, I am burnt out. I've got nothing left to give. So the customer asked me, have you got anything? I said, I can come up with this concept for you.
Yeah.
And I narrowed 15 stages down to 6.
Yeah.
Based on my own experience and what I could see. And I also came up with, you talked about analogies. I think people respond to analogies and metaphors.
They do,
It's how people learn, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
So I came up with the ladder idea, which was, originally I talked about going down a ladder.
Yeah.
But actually we go up ladders, don't we?
We do.
We go, we have property ladders.
Yeah.
We have career ladders.
We do, yeah.
We're social climbers. We always say, oh, you're going up in the world.
Yeah.
So I thought it was a kind of a concept that people could resonate with.
Yeah.
But on this particular ladder, you don't want to be on it.
No.
Because as you're climbing this ladder, it's starting to burn from under you.
Right.
And that's the imagery I'm trying to create without being too dramatic and frightening about it. Because on the early designs of my book cover,
you
know, there's a ladder and it's clearly burning.
Yes.
But it was very like in your face burning.
Right.
And I had some feedback from friends and, you know, and other people I'd asked for feedback on it.
Yeah.
They said, God, it makes me feel like shocked inside, you know. The thought of all that fire, you know. So I thought, well, I better tone it down a bit. But I do like the concept. I do like the concept of going up this ladder, but don't be on this ladder.
But I think sometimes we also have to be realistic here, because as you said, this kind of thing creeps up on us. Initially, it's going on very subconsciously. We don't even see what's happening. So the fire is already burning under our feet and we don't even know it's there.
No, we don't.
So I think sometimes you have to be a little bit out there with this kind of stuff, because people just don't realize. And I think what you're saying is, by the time they realize, it can often be too late. Or yes. you're a long way down the track where you don't want to be.
Correct.
Don't want to be.
Yeah, correct. And I think people don't see it. And I'm seeing this, and I know at some point we'll go into the detail of the mm-hmm. what the different rungs mean. But people tend to come to, if we think of the ladder, there's six rungs of the ladder.
Right.
And if we think that it's split into three stages, early, middle, and late,
right.
People come in middle stage of their journey up the ladder. Because in the early stages, life's just too exciting at that point.
Right.
And they're probably too early in it and think, this is just the way it's going. And in another month, everything will be okay. And I'll be over this little hump and, you know, I'll be able to enjoy my life again. So they kind of just keep going. And at the end of the ladder, when they're getting into kind of what's called embers stage, they're just too depressed and burnt out to ask for help. In the middle stage, they realize, this isn't going very well at all. And this isn't just a one-off. This is something that's happening to me every day and it's ruining my whole life. That's when they come to me. And when I have this questionnaire in the book, it's a 60-question survey. You can get it on the website as well, but I'd rather you buy the book. And they send it in to me and they submit the survey. It takes 10, 15 minutes.
Which I did.
You've done it?
Yeah,
absolutely done it. I'm pleased to say.
I found the question is really interesting, Alan.
Okay.
Actually, yeah. Quite thought-provoking at times.
In a good way?
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm always interested in this type of thing. Now, I don't think I'm anywhere near burnout now in my career. I can think back to times when maybe I would have been higher at that ladder with it burning underneath me and I didn't realise that was what was going on.
Yeah.
And of course it also happens outside of our work life. I mean, there was 3 years ago, my father-in-law sadly died. My wife at the same time was quite seriously ill, which could have been life-threatening if we hadn't have got it sorted straight away. And then she had a really bad reaction to all of that happening in the same week. And then she was quite poorly with her own mental health for a while. And I remember 6 months down the line with a widow to look after a family with young kids whose mum wasn't quite where she needed to be. And I used the phrase, I think halfway through that year to Rich, I'm feeling a little bit burnt out because it's been so difficult. And, you know, our business was booming and there was all that to contend with as well. So I think it sometimes isn't just our work life. It can be all these other things that feed in. Yeah. And luckily, I recognise that this is not good. You know, if I carry on like this, this is leading nowhere good for me, for my family. But we don't always realise that soon enough, do we? And that's the problem. So that analogy of you going up a ladder, which on one thing is I'm going up in the world, but actually it's burning underneath me. As soon as I'm going to fall quite badly and hurt myself.
That's right.
I like that analogy. I really do like that analogy.
And I'm glad you do. And the other part of it is the higher we go, sometimes the scarier it gets to, you know, because then you're suddenly a long way from the ground.
Absolutely.
You know, so there's that analogy and metaphor to take in as well. So yeah, they come to me in those middle stages.
Yeah.
Because they've still got some get up and go. You know, hang on, you know, I've got something about, I'm stressed, but I've got energy still. I need to do something. What do I do? And so that's tend to be when they come for help.
So you road tested the idea, and we'll get into the ladder, as you say, in the various rungs in a minute. So you road tested this idea with your client. At what point did you think, I need to turn this into a book?
Oh yeah, good question.
Because I know you've been trying to write a book for a long time.
Yeah, we ran a little course, just a little pilot thing. And then I think one day I decided that I was starting to get upset because I was upset. The market, if you like. So dealing with companies, and you know what it's like.
Yeah.
You are very much dependent on budgets.
Right.
And you're dependent on one person saying yes or no.
Yeah.
And I used to get, frankly, a bit annoyed when you'd have a conversation with a customer and say, this is a great idea, but I can't do it.
Right.
So I thought, well, why don't I skip, you know, the middleman and go straight to the end user?
Okay.
So I thought, I've got all these, this concept and these tools.
Yeah.
So why don't I just write a book? Because, and I thought not only from the sense of Well, it's good to get to an individual person who would pay £10.99 mm-hmm. rather than, you know, maybe thousands of pounds for a course or something. You know, they can get to it, but also as a lead magnet too.
Yeah.
So, you know, my big hope is that one day, you know, a CEO of a big organization will get hold of this book, and I often leave copies on a train or in a hotel. Someone will pick it up and go, well, this is, you know, you're enjoying it.
Yeah.
So maybe they will too. And they'll say, I need this for my people. And so, you know, I can start to build relationships that way again with customers.
How easy was it to write? Because, I mean, you're diving into your own personal history and your own personal, you know, dark thoughts, I guess, from, you know, previous
not
experiences.
All my dark thoughts are in there.
No, not all of them.
I've held some back for the second one.
But it must have been, was it an easy thing to do to write the book, or was it quite hard to write the book?
It was actually really easy to write.
Was it?
Yeah, and I say that not glibly or, you know, it was hard in the sense that some days, I mean, I got into a writing habit.
Okay.
So in the summer, it was the summer before last, and I was just getting up at 6 o'clock every morning, and it was light outside, and I'd go and sit in the garden and just you know, type out 1,000 words a day. And I wouldn't worry too much about, are these the right words? Because I can sort that out later. I just had to get out of my head what I wanted to say.
Right.
And because of the structure of the ladder, so basically I just talk about what is burnout, why do we as humans get burnout, what can companies do about it? But then after that, it's simply about these are the stages. And at stage ignition, here are the things you can do about it. And
so
there's 6 rungs of the ladder,
yeah,
and there's 18 tools in total, so 3 per rung.
Yeah.
And I found that it sort of wrote itself.
Okay.
Because the structure was easy.
Yeah.
You know? But the hard bit was editing it.
Right.
And I set myself a deadline to get the book out by a certain point in early December. And I just made it a rigid thing that I was going to do this. And I was naive to the process. I self-published. I did have a self-publishing coach who gave me some inadequate advice.
Okay.
And my manuscript was too rough to go off to the editor, meaning when it came back to me, I spent 2 weeks working 12, 14 hours a day just accepting or rejecting the changes she'd made.
Right.
We're talking little bits of grammar or style or whatever it was. And that nearly killed me.
So hi, it's Dave again. That's the end of episode 1 of this conversation with Alan Muscat. We'll be back next week with part 2. If today's episode has struck a chord, please share it with someone that you might know that might need to hear it. Please give us a 5-star rating on your podcast channel, because this really helps us to get reach and inspire more leaders. Every week we send out a newsletter called Foresight, containing top tips from each episode. There's also a book recommendation, a thought to reflect on, and some practical takeaways that you can apply in your day-to-day life. Visit zentanogroup.com/podcast, add your name to our mailing list. But for today, thank you for listening.